All right, friends, Greg Kokel, live and kind of lively here on Sunday afternoon. I have to say live because I haven't been live the last 2 weeks. And thank you for your patience with me being on the road. I have missed you. And I've wanted to talk to you about so many things that are now behind us, no longer timely. I've got a scratchy throat. I've been in 5 states in the last 2 weeks, 3 different university campuses, in addition to churches and seminars and conferences and fundraisers for crisis pregnancy centers and women's homes. I've been in Pennsylvania, Indiana, Northern California, Nevada, and Las Vegas a couple of days ago, North Dakota earlier in the week. It's cold there, by the way. Minnesota, crossed the river from Fargo, where I was at North Dakota State University, in addition to working with a fundraiser for Lutherans for Life there in Fargo, North Dakota. By the way, I added my 50th state. That was my 50th state. I finally run the table with all the states. I told the folks in Fargo I saved the best for last. And the problem is, it's like, you know, Maine and North Dakota aren't on their way to anywhere. You know, Maine was my 49th state. Alaska I landed in a couple of years ago on my way to, you know, other climbs. So I kind of logged that one in, but I finally got all 50. But you can tell my voice is a little under the weather because I've done so much speaking in the last few weeks, and sometimes I came back for a day or two and was on the plane again, and other times I was back for just a few hours. I came in at 8 o'clock one evening, and I was at the airport at 4:30 the next morning, so that happened twice. But I am glad to be back home, and this week kind of ends a long run of hard work, and I say that all not to impress you, but by way of apologies for not being with you the last couple of weeks. Actually, in a couple of days, I take another trip to San Antonio, Texas, but that's with my wife, and it's a little bit more relaxing at ETS, Evangelical Theological Society, and EPS, Evangelical Philosophical Society, which meet concurrently. So I get to rub shoulders with all the big boys and converse with them a little bit and learn a few things and make more contacts, and then we'll be teaching at Bill Craig's conference there in San Antonio, his apologetics conference. I'll be doing the final plenary session on Saturday and speaking in church on Sunday, then coming back here, and I'll be with you then for the rest of the year, which I'll be glad to do. But part of the reason that I'm mentioning this is not only to say my apologies, but I was engaged in some pretty intense stuff, but also to underscore that it's been pretty intense stuff. I mean, at the universities, at these fundraisers, talking in the churches, and boy, there's a lot going on in the world for Christians to be involved in, friends. We're really involved in a battle. And this really is my lead-in to my first hour of discussion with you and my guest. To put it simply, we're in serious times. And one of the things that has been a significant part of my own public speaking, and certainly the talking here on this program, is to try to invest in all the listeners, not only giving the tools that will help them to meet the needs of these times, but to give you a sense of urgency about the times that we live in. There are many momentous things taking place, and in one sense, all periods of time have been serious for Christians because our message is serious. It's a message of eternal consequence, and God has entrusted us with carrying that message as ambassadors to the rest of the world. But having said that, it seems that there are unique and challenging concerns that we face right now that that invite us, more than that, they beckon us to be much more sober-minded and more serious about the serious times in which we live so that we might make our mark. And it's, I think, with this kind of sentiment and with a kindred spirit to those comments that I just made that James Emery White has written this book, Serious Times. He's our guest today, and we're going to be chatting about his book. James White has got, he's the founder and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's got a PhD from Southern Seminary. He studied in postgraduate work at Vanderbilt University and Oxford. He's also been a visiting professor around town, including at Moscow Theological Institute. He's now adjunct professor of Christian theology at Gordon-Conwell. In addition to all of these degrees, he's actually seems to have quite a heart, too, if I understand what I'm reading well in his book, Serious Times. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
It's, you know, you look at the your list of credentials, and I mean, it's very impressive, and that's why it's,
most of them are lies. I just thought
it just gives you, it makes you look great. But you really write with a tremendous amount of sensitivity in this book, and I really like that. One thing that you've brought to this book, Serious Times, is a serious challenge for Christians to rise to the occasion. But it's not just a patent battle call kind of thing, but it's a real challenge to broaden our hearts, as Augustine said, you know, broaden the mansions of our souls, as it were, because it's not just knowledge, but a deeper in a very genuine and profound sense relationship with Christ that is going to make the difference in our serious times, right?
Yes, and I think that's probably one of the benefits of having one foot in academia and the study of culture and another foot rooted as the pastor of a local church.
Mm-hmm.
Keeps you honest, keeps you very much tuned in to how we need to translate everything that we're learning, everything
right.
that we're thinking about, translate the challenge into what it means to really impact the society when we go to our schools and our jobs, our marriages, our families, and engage the world Monday through Saturday.
Right. You're a braver man than I am, James. Well, I go out and I tell folks, as I did on these trips, I said, you know what, I'm a hit-and-run kind of guy. I'm in here today and I'm gone tomorrow. They're the ones that are toughing it out on the front lines of battle, and my hat, it goes off to them. And if I can give a little bit, a piece of encouragement or some tools to do the job, then I'm glad to be able to make the contribution. And I think that's the spirit in which you've written Serious Times, and we'll get into the details of it in just a moment. But the idea of the fact that all Christians are on the front lines, as a matter of fact, and the sooner we realize that and in a sense step up to the plate, the greater impact we're going to have in this critical issue of the kingdom in the context of the 21st century.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the frustrations that I had, and one of the reasons I wanted to pursue the material in this book and the study of this book in the way that I did, is that when you look at what is a lot of what is being written, particularly, and by the way, kudos to you. I've enjoyed learning about your ministry, and I like the way you're bringing things together that are often not connected. And I think that we are kindred spirits.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Because what I was seeing out there was that you had, on the one hand, some people who were fairly gifted at cultural analysis,
mm-hmm.
but they were not bringing it, popularizing it in a way that most people could wrap their arms around, and it was divorced from both application, kind of like, well, what do we now do,
mm-hmm.
and also divorced from spiritual formation.
Mm-hmm.
And
we are.
A lot of books out there on spiritual formation
mm-hmm.
that seemed like they hadn't read a newspaper in the last 6 months.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I think that those are the two things that I know that I'm very committed to trying to bring together. Certainly in this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I never liked the idea, speaking to your first comment there about what some people would say is you put the cookies on the lower shelf. And the part of the reason I didn't like that is because some of the cookies can't get there, you know. You just, some things are just, you can't reduce them down to cookies, as it were, but you can make them within reach if people are willing to work a little bit. And your writing style is one, I think, that captures what I just heard a couple of weeks ago. Someone said, you got to throw the ball so people can catch it, you know. And I think you've done that. You start out with a kind of historical analysis and walk us through a little bit of history based on your education, your background in this, but you do so in a very winsome fashion. But there was really something, before we get into that, that really launched you off in this project. You had a kind of a epiphany of sorts as you were thinking about your own life, the issue of significance. You want to share that with us a bit?
Sure, I don't mind that at all. I had a fairly significant event that was very influential in bringing me to Christ. I became a Christian in my 20s,
mm-hmm.
My early 20s, through a ministry, college campus ministry, InterVarsity.
Mm-hmm.
Had some Christian friends reach out and build a relationship with me and invite me to this, and I was kind of an oddball in that I was not an easy evangelistic nut to crack.
Yeah.
I had been reading everything from C.S. Lewis to Francis Schaeffer and so forth before I was a Christian.
No kidding.
And just for intellectual recreation, I think.
Uh-huh.
So, but what happened was, one of the events that I talk about in the book was, and this may seem a little superficial to some people, but it was very real to
mm-hmm.
me. I was working out in Colorado one summer, and for one of my father's companies, and I went, had a weekend off, and I went to Colorado State University, And I went to see a movie that had just been released, and it was the second installment of the original Star Wars trilogy, mm-hmm. Empire Strikes Back.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was watching that film and seeing this farm boy swept up into this galactic struggle of good versus evil,
right.
I remember I walked out of the theater absolutely staggered.
Hmm.
I just remember sitting in my car in the parking lot, overwhelmed with a single thought, and it was, this is what I want for my life. I want to be caught up in the sweep of history. I want to be making a difference. I want to be at the heart of the struggle between right and wrong and good and evil. And I remember thinking to myself, but where can that happen in this world?
Mm-hmm.
How can I really be part of something that is bigger than I am? And I'll never forget, just it came pounding into my soul that was what God's invitation to the Christ life is all about, that mm-hmm. there really is that kind of cosmic struggle going on, and that can impact all of history. I could be a player. I could be a warrior. I could be a part of that struggle and that great revolution.
Yeah, so this was even before you were a believer. Is that right? Is this?
Yeah, actually, that was before I was a Christ follower, and then that began a whole series of events that led me to Christ
mm-hmm.
halfway through my college
mm-hmm.
career.
This is very significant, partly because I think the tendency nowadays, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'd like to hear your response to this. The tendency nowadays, if anything, is to be lowering the bar in the church, in our youth groups, and not raising the bar. And it isn't just to get the cookies in the lower shelf so people can understand the things. I mean, I agree with the sentiment there, what you want to do. I just don't think it can all go down there. People have got to reach for the good stuff, and it's our job to help them to reach effectively. I think that rather, people have just been shying away from challenge because they're afraid they're going to chase people away. And so you have this whole seeker-sensitive movement that just abhors anything, it seems to me, that could possibly be, turn somebody off or be too big of a burden. And so we just got to gentle it in and not scare them away, when in fact it may be the case that what people are really hungering for is a challenge that's much bigger than they are. And this is the kind of challenge that followers of Jesus Christ have risen to the occasion to respond to. For 2,000 years.
Yeah, two things on that. One is, you're absolutely right. When we're wanting to popularize things and try to bring truth to a level that people can grab onto, we're not wanting to dumb it down,
mm-hmm.
but we are wanting to convey it, as you mentioned, in a popular way. That's what made C.S. Lewis obviously
right.
so
mm-hmm.
effective. He never dumbed anything down, but he was. He simplified it, which
he
is
sure
why
did.
Other professors at Oxford used to tease him about being a plain Jack for the plain person. They
mm-hmm.
actually thought that in simplifying he was losing something, but I think anyone who reads Lewis realizes no, he was actually kind of taking the Jesus approach, which
mm-hmm.
simplify but not superficialize.
Right. Uh-huh.
In terms of the second thing, in terms of the challenge and commitment, you're right. I do think that people today are much more attracted to strong challenges and commitments and calls, which is one of the things that I think Christians have failed to realize. I mean, just look at cults, the attraction of cults. The most effective cults are the ones that raise the bar the highest in terms of, unfortunately, a works righteousness.
Yeah, way too high, actually,
yeah,
but it's amazing how people respond to that.
Yeah, but it does show that how people are not stirred by limp-wristed, tame challenges or causes. And I do think that when movements such as the seeker-sensitive or the seeker-targeted movement are at their best, they are playing with methodology but not message or challenge. In fact, the challenge and the ones that are really effective
mm-hmm.
is coming through extremely strong,
mm-hmm.
and that's when that particular movement actually is at its best.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. So serious times. Here you have early in the book, in the introduction, in fact, you quote Thomas Paine, "These are the times that try men's souls," a quote familiar to many, but then you follow with his next remark, "The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country." Point being, these are tough times, and unless we rise to the occasion, we're not going to be able to do the job. How does that inform, in a sense, the theme of this book?
I think that one of the things that is my hope and prayer for this book is that people will read it and get a grasp of the flow of history that has brought us to this moment, what is happening in our culture, and the challenge that it brings to how we lead our lives, minds, our role in the church, and our vocation. And so I think that the danger in our day is that we will face this challenge, or see the challenge, I should say, and do nothing. Or feel like someone else will do it, kind of the bystander issue.
The Kitty Genovese situation, where everybody is watching her being stabbed to death, expecting somebody else to help her, and nobody did anything.
In fact, I actually mentioned that in the closing chapter about that very specific situation.
You have her picture in there, in fact.
Yeah,
very, very moving.
I was very surprised to be able to find, and but I was glad to do that. I think that there is a real... I think one of the biggest problems that Christians face today is apathy, and you know, seeing it but not wanting to respond to it, or not feeling the need to respond to it, or shrinking from the depth of the challenge.
You know, I mentioned earlier I was at North Dakota State University earlier in the week, and I met there with Christian faculty who are trying to deal with, you know, being followers of Jesus Christ, faithful followers of Christ, in the context of a secular campus. And this is one of the things they brought up, in a general apathy. And I get this question a lot. How do you deal with apathy? I don't know if you would just mention apathy in the church, and so my suspicion is what you see in the culture is being is influencing the church. And your answer to apathy in the church is to raise the bar, it sounds like, and help people to see what's at stake here, especially in the flow of history and seeing our position in the entire game here.
Absolutely. I think step one is awareness, just to see what is happening, see the challenge, see the dire state of our culture, understand the nature of it. I mean, to really awaken ourselves to what is happening right now on this planet. But then second, working to really help people realize how they can, in their life, become a player, become someone who can actually engage it. Normally, the reason I think the breakdown is between one of those two. Either we're not effectively helping people realize the nature of the times, or secondly, we're not helping them realize the serious nature of how their life can engage it. That's why the book almost has two parts. The first part is, here are the serious times.
Right.
Second part is, here's the serious life.
Right, and we'll talk about both of those in just a minute. I think there's maybe a third thing here, and you may address it because I haven't completely finished the book. It was like between airplane jaunts, you know. Here I am with my book there, going through the material. But I think there are times when you get strong challenge from the pulpit, but what you don't get is the people aren't given the tools that are necessary to take up the challenge.
Yeah, all revved up with nowhere to go.
Yeah, because the pastors may not understand the nature of the challenge themselves, and this is where I think the historical material that we'll cover in just a few moments will help people. The book here is Serious Times. My guest, James Emery White. James, do you like James or Jim? What do you usually go by?
Either one.
Okay, good, because you know, usually they have Gregory on my book, and nobody calls me that except for my mom when she's angry at me. So James Emery White, a publisher, InterVarsity Press, and this is we have this at Stand to Reason, folks, so you can call us during the week at 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason, and order this. But this is a very readable book. I mean, it's not this massive tome. You'll look, pick it up, and it's less than 200 pages, and it's just nicely laid out, nicely written, easy to follow, and we'll talk about more of the content when we return. I'm Greg Kokel, and the show is Stand to Reason. Stay with us. Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea, cruising the Alaskan coast, along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005 for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers, this cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise, it's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there.
Went to a garden party to reminisce with my old friend. Chance to share old memories, play a song again.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And before we get back to James Emery White and his very fine book, Serious Times, just a reminder, we have been talking a little bit in the last couple of months just about our financial situation and simply reminding you that this radio show is listener-supported. We almost never talk about that. And I think as a result, we have it about half-funded, you know. We have some people have been on board for a long time, and they've been faithfully sending us money to help that out. The rest of the funding for this show has come out of our general account, which could be going for other things. And every once in a while, we get a letter from somebody that that mentions how much we've helped them and how glad they have been to learn. And so they're responding. In fact, here's a quick one from a young lady named Sarah from Grand Rapids, Michigan area. I was just there about 4 weeks ago. I recently became a builder, she said. This is a category of giving a certain amount per month. And I did this online when I realized how much I use your website. I apologize for not giving sooner. I plan on sending $50 a month and will keep STR in my prayers. I was able to see you recently in Grand Rapids where I purchased the ABCs, that's the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, and your book on relativism. I'm not the fastest learner. However, I'm grateful to be able to study along with your knowledge. Thank you all for all you do for Christianity. And she signs it, Sarah. And we always appreciate letters like that. For one, it encourages us. We like to know we're making a difference. And it also is, I can get to read it to you guys to encourage you and also to put a reminder. Here's somebody who's used our website for a long time and decided, well, you know what, maybe I should be helping that enterprise. Paul writes that he who receives the good things that are being taught should share the good things, the financial good things, with him who teaches. In this case, it's to keep us going so that we're available to you. So if this might be the time, November, towards the end of the year, when you might want to consider helping out with our radio, if not a monthly gift, maybe a one-time gift, you can send it to Stand to Reason. I'll give you the address in just a moment. Just make it out to Stand to Reason. You can give us a call. That's the easiest thing. 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason, during office hours during the week. And just say, you know what, I'd like to help out with the radio work that you're doing to keep you on the air. And here's my gift. And we can take a credit card number or whatever over the air. If you want to mail in a check, here's the address. 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Once again, 1438 East 33rd. Signal Hill, California, 90755. And we'd love to hear from you. And if you want to send a check and write a little note like this, who knows, maybe it'll get read on the air. But we appreciate Sarah and all the rest of you who have been helping and the rest of you listening who are going to kind of ante up and help us out with the radio show. We've been here for 14 years, and for about half of that time, it's been listener-supported, and we are so thankful for the help that you give us. Now, from Serious Things to Serious Times, and James Emery White, this book published by InterVarsity Press. James, in your book, you set us up for kind of a perspective of the present serious times that we're in by marching us a little bit through history in a very accessible way as you look at kind of the history of thought in Western civilization that brings us to this point. Can you give us a little thumbnail sketch of that?
Yeah,
it's 25 words or less.
I remember when I sketched that out, and I said, okay, I'm going to take people from the medieval to the modern period in one chapter. And,
yeah.
But I think sometimes it really helps to take a 30,000-foot level.
Yeah, it does.
Of history, and there's two ways to do it. One is to to do history is be very intricate, very involved, multi-volume, and cover everything and dot every I and cross every T.
And you get lost in the trees.
Yeah, and the other one is to really say, well, let's just look at the real sweep of things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the heart of what I am trying to get across in that chapter, and let me introduce it, and then I will go back and tell you what I mean by that.
Sure.
Is that there has been a second fall.
Mm-hmm.
The first fall led to God's expulsion of human beings from the Garden of Eden. The second fall was when we returned the favor.
Mm.
One of the things that's happening in our world today is that the leaders of science and education, political machinations, commerce, have really ceased operating with any reference to a transcendent truth, much less a God. Now, that's a very new and very profound break with the entire flow of history of Western thought and culture.
It's important that I want to underscore that comment you just made, that this is very new and it's a very profound break with the past, because most of us alive today have been born and raised through, I should say most of our listeners, been born and raised in a period where this has almost been taken for granted, there is this radical disjunctive here between God and the rest of life. And what Francis Schaeffer called the upper story shift, as it were, which required an upper story leap, the separation of nature and grace. And this is what you're talking about, this radical divorce, this rejection, this second fall.
Oh, sure, because, I mean, even among, you know, past cultures that we might call, from a Christian perspective, pagan, the kind of secularity of our day was completely unknown, because you know, I mean, whether it was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or the gods of Greece and Rome, I mean, there were gods.
Right.
And people looked to a world beyond the one in which they lived, and they lived accordingly. Yeah. No one would have started from themselves alone and tried to reach any kind of sense of truth and morality. And the second fall changed all of that. Now, what I do in particularly the chapter on history is I really work hard to get that grand, fast, because it was rapid, sweep of things from the medieval to the Enlightenment to kind of chart that this really was a fall. I mean, this really was a drastic, massive break. I believe that, and many scholars now are starting to really view that the heart of our Western culture, a lot of its dynamics, were really formed within the medieval, even more so than ancient Greece and Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And from the so you could make a case to start from the medieval, which was a profoundly Christian world.
Mm-hmm.
Not a golden age, but of faith. Certainly had all of its warts, but it was a profoundly Christian world. And then from the medieval, we went into the Renaissance. And the Renaissance was a fascinating time, because the Renaissance was when it could have gone either way. We could have sharpened up the medieval Christendom. We could have brought it into a more balanced, biblical, authentic type of Christendom. Or we could have gone the way of the Enlightenment. Because what happened with the medieval is that we started off with humanism, as most people know. I mean, the Renaissance ushered in humanism. Mm-hmm. But at the beginning, it was a Christian humanism.
Right. It wasn't man the measure of all things, right?
No, it was just a rediscovery of the proper place of man. Because in the medieval period, actually, humanism, in the best sense of the word, had been devalued in a way that really did not bring honor to what God had did in the creation of human beings in the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really could have gone either way. The early part of the Renaissance, it was a robust Christian humanism. The second part of the Renaissance is when we lost it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it became a secular humanism, or as you mentioned Schaeffer earlier, Schaeffer would have called it an autonomous.
Right, right. Now, the early part of the Renaissance, what are some of the names that people might associate with that period that you're describing there?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that if you want to talk about a group of people who took good advantage of early Renaissance humanism, it would be the Reformers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Reformation, I mean, there's an old line that Luther hatched the egg that Erasmus had laid.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a fair amount of truth to that. But that early humanism was really a dialogue of Rome with Rome. And what I mean by that is, and that's not my line, that's Fernand Braudel's, who's a social historian, talks about a dialogue of pagan Rome and Christian Rome, between classical and Christian civilization. In fact, I was in Rome, Italy, this summer doing some study at the Vatican and some other areas there. And you can actually, a lot of people don't know that Raphael painted the pagan god Apollo on the walls of the papal apartments in Rome, not in honor of that, not as a sign of acceptance, but it was interesting to see how deep the dialogue was going on. And the idea was to look at the entire world through a Christian worldview, which obviously is something profoundly important.
Right.
But so while there was this return to things classical, it was done in light of a creator. It was a Christian. It was a sacred humanism. And the reformers built off of that. But when it became a secular humanism, divorced from biblical revelation, divorced from a Christian worldview, it became incredibly destructive. It was a return to Athens, but it bypassed Jerusalem.
And this is probably names like Immanuel Kant and David Hume and René Descartes might come to mind.
Well, they were actually the products of that. I would put them more in terms of the Enlightenment, but you're right. They were the ones, particularly, I would say, Kant is the poster boy of the Enlightenment.
So, it was their contribution that created this radical, this ability then to make this radical move away, divorcing reason from revelation, if I understand your analysis.
Yeah, because what happened when, toward the end of the Renaissance, that humanism did become increasingly secular, the people that we would classify as Enlightenment thinkers, they were the ones that took that, made, with man as the measure of all things as opposed to God, and ran with it. That is what really created the Enlightenment and what fueled the Enlightenment and was the heart of Enlightenment thought. Because when Kant, for example, his famous phrase, dare to know, what he was really saying was dare to know by yourself, in and of yourself, independent of God or revelation, start with yourself and end with yourself. And that is that was unheard of. And of course, Voltaire went even further, saying that what we're really wanting to do is to get away from any submission to God or heavenly will altogether. And of course, you know, the crowning moment, and I talk about this in the book, that I think was the epitome of how the second fall through the Enlightenment, or at the end of the Enlightenment, finally really did take hold, was that event on November 10th of 1793, when the Notre Dame, the great church of France, most famous of all the Gothic cathedrals, was formally declared the Temple of Reason. And you had busts of Rousseau and Voltaire taking the place of the busts of the saints that had been there. And literally, they wrote a hymn. And this was something that I uncovered in my research that I found absolutely riveting, but also
appalling.
Was that they wrote a hymn for the ceremony where they declared the church the Temple of Reason, and they said, "Reason be the goddess of the French, be our goddess." It really was an amazing thing, and that was, for me, in many ways, the symbol of the Second Fall,
of course,
now
then,
being complete.
Right, and the reverberations of that, of course, that we have now a modern day understanding of science, which is, you know, science writ broadly, I guess, back then, was how we know about the real world, as it were, the nature of reality, you know, understood very broadly. Now it is naturalistic science, which is completely divorced from anything supernatural or immaterial, and this is the governing, ruling a system of knowledge in our culture. Now we've inherited it, and now it's almost commonsensical to people. Of course, science teaches truth, and there isn't anything else. This is how far we've come in that second fall.
And what's interesting about what you just raised, Greg, is that that's one of the interesting dynamics right now between modernity and postmodernity, because what you just described is exactly where modernity landed and was the primary philosophical foundation for modernism, was a form of reductive naturalism.
Right.
And I don't want to jump ahead of our discussion here, but what is interesting about the dynamic of postmodernism is that, and this is where there is both promise and peril with postmodernism, but postmodernism looks at what you just said as a description of modernism, which is accurate, and said, you know what? They don't buy it.
Right.
They do not believe that science is what modernists say it was, which is the epitome of all truth. And that's one of the things that is so fascinating right now about the postmodern currents of thought. There's a sense that, no, there it does not explain everything. Science is not the handle of all truth. There is something more out there. We don't know what it is. It may be Christianity. It may be Wicca. It may be Scientology. But we don't think science is the last word.
It can't deliver on its promise, in other words. But my take on it is, it isn't like they've said, now in the postmodern mind, and we can talk more, we're going to come into a break in just a few moments, but I'd like to talk more about that and also about how the Christian responds, not only dealing with the mind part, but also expanding a soul, which is a very important part of your book. Because, you know, modernity didn't deliver on its promise, it isn't, it seems to me, that postmoderns have figured, well, maybe there's more to life than just science. It seems to me the whole paradigm itself, it's being chucked out, that there is anything you can know for sure, that there is any reality out there as it really is in itself that can be discovered, which is what science allegedly is trying to find out. And then all of those people that sound like they're in that tradition who know something true, which would include Christians, get chucked out in the process, you know.
Absolutely.
I'd like to make
a comment in the book that I think that postmodernity is really more about the exhaustion of modernity than it is something radical.
Well, why don't you take a minute, 60 seconds, I know postmodernity, 60 seconds, but just talk about what that looks like coming out of modernity, because I don't want to give you the short shrift here in our last 20 minutes or so on the more of the spiritual formation material that's in there. So,
well, what postmodernity does is that it's a morphing of modernity, and I'm kind of bypassing what modernity is, but you gave a great succinct discussion of at least the scientific part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But postmoderns look at modernity, and they have a very much a changing view of reality, a changing view of truth, and that there isn't a meta-narrative, there isn't one grand story out there that encompasses everything, and that reality is very subjective, it's very based on our own perceptions and what we think it is, very, very subjective.
Mm-hmm.
Really, Nietzsche, if you have any exposure at all to Nietzsche, you understand postmodernity, because he was postmodern before postmodern was cool.
Mm-hmm.
But what I find to be extremely interesting about postmodernity, more than anything, and this might be a good lead-in to our next conversation, is that it really is also a deep, deep, deep search for the spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about most individuals today that I encounter, and about 70 to 80% of the total growth of Mecklenburg comes from those who were previously unchurched.
Mm-hmm. That would be your church there in North Carolina, right?
We specialize in those who, quite frankly, don't give a rip about Jesus. They are very open to spiritual things,
mm-hmm.
and they're really not atheists.
Mm-hmm.
They're not militant skeptics. They're really more like mystics who have no theology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or their theology is taken from 1,000 pop culture formations.
Well, you know what this reminds me of, and with this we'll take a break here, but it reminds me of what Francis Schaeffer has said, and frankly this is my modus operandi in dealing with postmoderns. I mean, people have all different ideas about how to do this. Some of it means adapting to their worldview. Others mean accepting their worldview, like they're right and we're wrong, so let's just join them kind of thing. And I think there's merit to the first, and I think the second is dreadful and it's a serious problem. But I remember what Francis Schaeffer said when he talked about taking the roof off. He said every man must live in the world that God actually made, and he actually is, as a matter of fact, made in the image of God. That means no matter how much he tries to deny the truth that is painted for us by the scriptures, God's world, he's got to live in it. So he always lives in a kind of contradiction. And there's always this tension. And I think we see this in the postmoderns, that even though they deny truth, to a great degree, at least the correspondence view, what we normally understand truth to mean, they still can't get away from the world they live in. And there is this deep spiritual hunger that's planted in them that hungers for the truth, the world as it really is, even while they deny that such a thing can exist.
They're more honest than the Enlightenment thinkers in that regard.
Yeah, so they're embracing their angst on this, and that gives us an opportunity to speak to them. And when we come back from break, we'll talk a little bit about what we say to them, and particularly how we develop our own souls in a way that brings is attractive to other seekers as well. I'm talking with James Emery White. Friends, I hope you get this book. It's entitled Serious Times, Making Your Life Matter in an Urgent Day. It's published by InterVarsity Press. We have it at Stand to Reason. You can call 1-800-913-9368. the number 2, and the word reason, and get it there if you'd like, and we'll ship it right out to you. It is well written. It's easy to follow. You pick it up and you start looking at it, and it doesn't seem cumbersome. It just, you can read almost anywhere and start enjoying it. But James sets out a historical course to bring us where we're at now, and then he goes into not only developing the soul and the mental part and the knowledge half, or the mind, I should say, developing the mind, but also developing the soul as well, a topic to which we'll return when we return here at Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kogel. Don't go away.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kogel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these 3 self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC Studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kogel back with you on Stand to Reason. And my favorite group. Actually, I don't know if it's absolutely my favorite, but I just like the period of time so much. And though now that I look back on it, those were serious times too. My guest today, James Emery White, his book Serious Times, Making Your Life Matter in an Urgent Day, must reading, I think, for the STR Ambassador for Christ. Published by InterVarsity Press, also available at Stand to Reason. And, boy, I don't know, we're kind of done with the history now, Jim, but as I look at what is happening today, I can see so many things as being the fruit of seeds that were planted in the 60s. And I was a child of the 60s myself, the 50s and the 60s. I don't know your age, but you look a little younger than me, but maybe not too much. You might remember those times, but that was a seedbed for what people are thinking nowadays, isn't it?
You know, it's interesting. I was listening to something the other day where an author, a sociologist, was discussing what era he wanted to invest his period of his life study in, and he picked the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
The reason he wanted to do the 60s was because when you look at where American culture was in 1960 and then where it was in 1970, never before in the history of American culture had 10 years changed the face.
Yeah.
Of the landscape more than in those 10 years, because you know the difference between 1950 and 1960 was not that significant, even
mm-hmm.
between 1970 and 1980. But where we landed in 1970 versus where we were in 1960,
mm-hmm.
dramatic.
Well, we had a counterculture revolution. We had three major assassinations, a president.
Primarily those two.
Pardon me?
1968 was the most tragic
yeah,
of all for that.
Right, both of the Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King there in. And then we had the Vietnam War. All of these things were catalysts, and they were, you know, just matches, powerful matches to a powder keg that had already been set by years before. So, but we want to talk now. We're going to shift gears. So there are many fascinating things we can pursue, and other things that you discuss in your book. I want to talk about the second area that we need to develop, that you're to be meat for serious times: our minds first, and also our souls. And you have a very specific way of cashing that out in your book. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, one of the things, as I mentioned earlier, is that if the first half of the book is serious times, the second half of the book is how to lead a serious life.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what I do in that second section is I say that if we're really going to engage the culture and make a difference with our lives, there's going to be two key investments and two key posts that we'll take. The two key areas of life that we're to invest in and develop is specifically deepening our souls and developing our minds. And then the two key outposts, the places that we are to take position in, are the church and our vocation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the format on that. And it's interesting. I have reflected for many, many years on exactly what is it a life is to do in response.
Mm-hmm.
Once one comes to Christ and understands the nature of the times. And I really have, in my own thinking, it may not be, of course, where everyone lands, but these really are the four areas: develop your soul, develop your mind, take your post in your vocation, and align yourself with the church and invest through that in God's great revolution.
Now, you mentioned
four areas are absolutely decisive to my thinking.
You mentioned here in your chapter called Interlude, you make the observation, what kind of Christian will it take to do this job of rise to the occasion? And you mentioned the world's full of Christ followers, committed ones, particularly in the United States, yet the tide does not seem to be turning. Is the problem here ignorance? Is it lack of leadership? Is it not having the tools?
It's interesting that you mention that, because I will say something that I do not mean to sound, as if I have certainly arrived. But I will say what I think is the critique of my own life,
mm-hmm.
and I fear it's the critique of many of my fellow Christ followers. I think our problem is we're not Christian enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think our problem is that we are not following Christ in such a way that we really are salt and light. I remember one time Gandhi was asked something. He said that the reason that Christianity had not taken hold in India was that the Christians there were not enough like Jesus.
Hmm.
And what he was saying was that a true Christian, really someone like Jesus, would have dwarfed Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is. I remember another situation. Billy Graham one time was talking to a person who was not a believer, and he said, "I think that I would consider Christianity or consider becoming a Christian if I could only meet one."
Yeah, I think it was Barnhouse who said that the two reasons people don't become Christians: one, they've never met a real Christian, and the second reason is they had, you know. So.
Exactly, and I think that one of the things that I know is my own, you know, just a personal commitment. I know it is yours as well, Greg, and your listeners, is that now that we've become Christians, let's really pursue what it means to be one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the real heart of the matter: salt and light. Now, I don't mean simply personal piety. I think, though, that that's certainly a deep part of it, but I think that what it means to increasingly become like Christ is where we are actively engaged in pursuing the development of our souls in such a way that our presence is almost scandalous in the world,
mm-hmm.
that it really is a formidable presence, and it marks everything that we engage. I think that's what we're after, so that when we are, I'm remembering something else now, even as I speak to you. I remember Thomas Merton one time saying that unless we become deeply like Christ, we will not have anything to offer the world that it does not already have.
Mm-hmm. Now, to some people, to hear that, and I would say even to myself, who as a committed Christian and engaged in the battle in these serious times, it that's somewhat of a daunting prospect.
Mm.
Because on the one hand, one realizes that it's never going to be the way it's supposed to be. But that, on the other hand, that doesn't mean that we give up in the process. So... I mean, I've never met a real Christian. Here's the guy talking to Billy Graham. I've never met a real Christian. Well, wasn't Billy Graham a real Christian? So tell us a little bit about the journey here, and you give some guidelines on how to deepen our souls in that chapter. And I think you do embrace this as a journey. This isn't kind of a perfectionism role. It's something we shoot for and we move forward. And you give us some very practical ways to begin making progress in that.
Yeah, one of the things that I think that I push for in the chapter on developing your soul is that we really have to look at developing something of a rule for our life,
mm-hmm.
where we pull from several areas.
This is the St. Benedict's influence you talk about.
Yeah, and you know, Greg, let me run a risk of something here that I think that most Christians are savvy enough to kind of track with. One of the things that was not good about the Reformation, if we can dare say that,
it's okay with me,
was that there was a 1,600 years of insight into spirituality and spiritual formation that we inadvertently kind of threw out, kind of threw out the baby with the bathwater.
Right.
And there's so much about that today when you talk to a Christian, you say, well, tell me what you're doing. And they really can't get much further than a quiet time.
Mm-hmm.
They really can't talk about spiritual formation much further than, well, I read my devotion today. And there's so much more.
And what you're talking about,
the prayer, so much more to reflective devotional reading of Scripture. There's so much more to silence and solitude and spiritual retreats, spiritual direction,
mm-hmm.
So much more to just developing a whole host of practices that can serve our life spiritually. And so in that chapter, I try to be very practical about how you really can deepen your soul.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that I'm and again, that may be the pastor part coming out in me, but there is so much to take advantage of. And most people are a little arid in their spiritual life.
Well, I certainly can relate to that, and we've talked about this on the show, and other people have mentioned it too. It's kind of a constant struggle. But what you're suggesting here with Saint Benedict's rule is just starting to develop some, for lack of a better word, rules. It has a pejorative sense now. I don't think it did then. But rules or guidelines or particular things we can do. You suggest starting small. Benedict had a very involved kind of series of things that his monks did. But you suggest starting small, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And really all I'm after when I talk about a rule, and I think all that Benedict was after, was what are the things that feed your soul?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of all the spiritual practices, of all the spiritual disciplines, of all the spiritual things that you can drink deeply from, what is it that most serves you? What is it that connects you to God? Everybody's wired up a little differently here. I mean, prayer and the Bible and things like that are givens, but there's so much out there to take advantage of. What would a rule look like for you? Now, all of us will be developing our rule our entire life,
mm-hmm.
but I know that where I'm at right now, it's very different than I was 5 years ago, and I look forward to what my rule might hold 5 years from now, but I develop a set of practices. In the book, I get as practical as I know how. I talk about how to do the things that I know I need to do that serve me. I have to rise at 5 in the morning.
Hmm.
And there are certain things that I do that I know that for me are critical to keeping my soul aligned with Christ and on anything akin to a growth track.
Mm-hmm.
I have to have, part of my rule is a monthly retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Part of my rule does involve, obviously, a daily quiet time of specifically about prayer. There are several things that are critical. In the book, I talk about how you can develop a rule, the kinds of things that you can draw from, and how to get this into your life, even if you're a soccer mom, if you are
mm-hmm.
working 60 hours a week, and as you described at the start of your program, you've been on more planes the last 2 weeks than you
mm-hmm.
can remember.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me offer a suggestion, not a suggestion, but an example just from my own life, and you tell me if this is what you're after here, because I know that I need to work God into my life on a more regular basis. In other words, I want to have a more of a conscious awareness of the presence of God, and that's hard when you're always distracted, you know, by work and other things. So a small thing that I've tried to do is that every night, just before I go to bed, I know this may sound almost simplistic, but I get down on my knees next to my bed, just like the picture of the kid, you know, in the storybook, and I thank God for the day. And what I'm simply trying to do, I'm not trying to have heavy-duty intercession, I'm just trying to review some of the things that happened during the day and be thankful for the particular ways that God helped me in each of those things, and then, you know, pray for a good night's rest and jump into bed. It probably takes me 60 seconds, but I find that if I can, as a rule, as a general practice, it helps to serve the development of thankfulness in my heart, a little bit more reflectiveness on God's work in my life, and an awareness that God is responsible for me and I should be giving thanks to Him on a regular basis. It's a small thing, but building regularity, isn't that the kind of thing you're talking about here?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I talk about in the book is how to begin to develop this in your life, and you alluded to it earlier. Start with small things, simple things, and build it into your life. Once you start anything, studies have shown that after about 6 weeks it becomes habit.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to invest the energy to keep it going. It's just part of your life.
Mm-hmm. A daily thing for 6 weeks, and then it's yours.
Exactly. It's just part of your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, like right now, I mentioned rising at 5.
Ouch. Yeah, you heard me groan.
I don't even set an alarm. My body just does it. It's just who and what I am.
Okay, after 6 weeks, has it gotten easier?
You know, as I was mentioning, right now I could go to bed at I think midnight and wake up at.
Oh gosh, it sounds painful. I tell people that before my first cup of coffee, I'm an atheist, man. So it's like that would be hard. But you know, I think part of what you said is everybody's different. You know,
everybody's different. Yeah, and what serves me is not what's going to serve someone else.
In maybe 60 seconds, talk a little bit about prayer. You mentioned Saint Teresa of Avila and her struggle. Even though she had a very robust, I think, prayer life, still it was a struggle for her. Is prayer a struggle for you? I think it is for many people. It certainly is for me.
I think it's a struggle for most people. I mean, even the great saints that we talk about who are the big models of prayer, and you mentioned Teresa of Avila, she shared in her journals just how difficult it is.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think that we need to remember is that prayer is not meant to be an experience-driven event.
Mm-hmm.
It's a relationship. Mm-hmm. And it's relationally driven. Mm-hmm. I remember reading once in C.S. Lewis saying that the prayers of dryness that we do out of dryness are the ones.
Yeah. James, we're out of time. Here comes the music. That means we got 20 seconds before I get cut off here. It has been a treat talking with you and reading your book. The book is Serious Times, Making Your Life Matter in an Urgent Day. We have it at Stand to Reason, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Call us during the week and pick this book up. James, I hope someday that we'll be able to meet. Are you going to be at ETS next week?
No, I won't. I'm going to be in Sweden.
Okay, well, I won't be there, but I hope someday we'll be able to meet, and it's been great talking with you.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
James Emery White, Serious Times, Making Your Life Matter in an Urgent Day. Get it, ladies and gentlemen. It is a very, very good book that will help your mind and your soul. That's it for this hour. Hour number 2 coming right up. 1-800-227-5278. Lines open. Give us a call. Okay, friends. Hour number 2. Actually, it's not a whole hour. It's only about 40 minutes. We're on our abbreviated winter schedule now for the next 3 months. And I'd love to talk with you. I've been absent from this seat for the last 2 weeks and will next week as well. So then you'll have me all the way to Christmas and into the new year. 1-800-227-5278. Lines wide open. Love to talk with you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150, 754-4150, if you'd like to call there. And while you're getting in the queue, I wanted to let you know about something that's happening tonight in Utah, and this is pretty amazing. I got an email from Craig Hazen. Many of you know Dr. Hazen. He runs the apologetics program over at Biola, the MA program there in Biola. He's also a former chairman of the board at Stand to Reason, still on our board, and a dear friend, and a guy that he's got tremendous faith. I mean, he's just amazing in this regard. Many of you might have remembered, or might remember, when, 10 years ago, the Worldwide Church of God, which was a Christian cult, that is a cult of Christianity, Sabbatarian, rejected the deity of Christ, works-oriented righteousness. In other words, we're contrary to a number of essential teachings of Christianity, where that when the founder died and new leadership came on board, in conversation with a lot of other Christians, made a radical change. And the radical change was from a cult of Christianity to a church of Christianity. This, based on the leadership of Joseph Tkach, who's the pastor general of the Worldwide Church of God now, and it was a pretty amazing thing. It had never happened before when a cult of Christianity got straightened out. And you got to imagine what kind of difficulty that actually entails. I mean, here a group for a long time, from their inception, holding to doctrines contrary to Orthodox Christianity, which they held were God revealed to their founder, and then read their Bibles in light of this interpretation, to actually essentially say everything we've been teaching you, or a great amount of it, certainly the core stuff, has simply been wrong. And the Christians were right all along. The mainstream evangelicals were right all along, and we're making a change. Now, a church like that is going to suffer a lot of losses when people go their own way, but a whole lot of people got converted to the truth at the same time. It was very difficult. And I've had, during that time, I was in conversations personally with some of the leadership there and visited them, and it was great to see what God was doing. Well, Craig Hazen doesn't think this is the only time that such a thing is going to happen. He thinks it may be happening in the future. And when he told me what he thought, I told him he was nuts. He thinks it's quite possible for Mormons to make the same change. Now, I know you're shaking your head too. This is lunacy. How could such a massive organization, who is deeply invested theologically in doctrines quite counter to our views, indeed were a church that was founded because our views, in their terms, Joseph Smith's, were an abomination to God, start moving around? But you know, there's been a number of people in close conversations with the LDS, and in fact, there's a great meeting tonight that I want you to know about and pray about. And I can say this to you because it's a public event. He says that many of you know that I've been involved in very high-level dialogues with leaders of the church, and he thinks the Lord is doing some very interesting things there. And as it turns out, this Sunday evening, November 14th, that is tonight, we will be witnessing a tremendous public leap forward in our talks. Ravi Zacharias, the spellbinding Christian teacher and evangelist, will be speaking in the Mormon Tabernacle in Temple Square in Salt Lake City. Ladies and gentlemen, that's tonight. That's the epicenter for Mormonism. This is the first time that a non-Mormon has spoken in this building since D.L. Moody did over 100 years ago. It is an unprecedented event for this generation of Mormons. He adds, then, I will also have an opportunity to address the LDS audience at this event, and so will my dear friends who have co-labored with me on this ministry to the Mormons for many years. And then he mentions Richard Mao, president of Fuller Seminary, David Neff, editor of Christianity Today, Craig Blomberg, professor of New Testament at Denver Seminary, Joseph Tkach, pastor general of the Worldwide Church of God, and Greg Johnson, director of Standing Together Ministries in Utah. This is a stellar group of stellar human beings, Christian people all, deeply invested in the serious times that we face on the battlefield, and now in high-level, significant discussions with leadership in the Mormon Church, such that even tonight they will be addressing audiences in the Mormon Tabernacle in Temple Square in Salt Lake City. Craig asked for prayer, and that the Lord would move mightily. The cause of the true Savior and the true gospel among the leadership would be made known. And, this is a pretty big deal. And lift up Ravi and me and the ministry team. We'd deeply appreciate it. So I am passing this prayer request onto you, and you can keep your eyes open. I still think, well, let's put it this way. My faith isn't big enough for that, but I'm glad that my faith isn't what runs anything around here, even stand a reason, and that it's in the Lord's hands. So we'll see what he's going to do. That's pretty neat, isn't it? All right, time to go to the phones, and first on board, Ty, welcome to Stand a Reason.
Hi, great, thank you.
Yes.
I have a few questions for you, if you have time.
Sure.
The first question is regarding abortion.
Okay.
I have quite a few conversations with people around here in San Diego, and usually prolific results as far as arguing for the pro-life position.
Prolific results? You mean people are responsive and change their mind, to put it simply?
I would say the
or influence.
Planted, and they definitely agree the argument is logical, and they sometimes call me back and ask me to kind of construe the argument one more time. So they're thinking about it. Other
good.
People have said that, yes, they would.
Well, that's great. Well, good for you.
Yeah, so it's going well. But somebody presented an argument to me that I have not heard yet.
Mm-hmm.
That was this, I usually argue from the zygote as a person, and you know probably the classic argument that anywhere you try and move forward from there
mm-hmm.
to find life, you usually the argument.
Well, there's no clear line of demarcation from the beginning of life at the zygote all the way to clear cases of persons that we can say is a, for any reasonable reason, is a demarcation between persons and non-persons, and so it seems reasonable to assume that the unborn is a person for the entire time, even though they don't have they are not exercising the capacities that most people consider to be the kinds of things that persons do.
Right. And usually they'll agree to that it seems to logically follow. If they follow it through, there's really nowhere else to go.
Mm-hmm.
But he presented this. He said, well, if I'm arguing that the zygote indeed is a person, then he was saying if he scraped a cell from his cheek, that cell contains the same information genetically as
mm-hmm.
zygote and the DNA molecule.
Yeah.
Thus, it's a person. I did answer it, but what's your response to that?
Well, I would say that we are not arguing. I'm not arguing that a zygote is a person because it's a cell with DNA in it.
Mm-hmm.
If I were making that argument, then we'd have to argue that the cells in your cheek are persons as well. I would argue, in fact, when I argue, I don't use personhood language. My argument is that the unborn is a human being for its entire existence. And humans are persons by nature. It is the invisible things that make a human is innately valuable in verse, and this is unrelated to any physical qualities that he happens to have. It is in virtue of the fact that a human is a human, that is, it is a unique kind of creature that bears a unique value, and it's not just an animal. It is an animal with transcendent value. It's therefore set apart from the rest of the animal kingdom. We have an animal nature, but it's more than that. Now, I think human beings, we all know this intuitively, and this is why we pass laws to protect humans. You can gas termites, but not human beings, you know, because of this distinction. And I argue that this is a value that humans have by nature, okay? So anytime you have a human being, regardless of the level of its development, you have the being with its nature, which nature is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, a zygote isn't just a cell or a clump of cells like you scrape off of your cheek. Another way to put it is this way. Somebody could say, well, that's just a clump of cells or a lump of cells or a lump of tissue. And my response is, so are you. You're a lump of cells, a lump of tissue, but you're not just a lump of tissue. You are a lump of tissue that happens to be a full human being, where in the case of the tissue in your mouth, that is tissue that isn't the full human being, but rather comes from a full human being.
Okay.
You could always ask the question, by the way, with regards to tissue you scrape from anywhere in your body, yes, this is human tissue. From whom did it come?
Mm-hmm.
All right? And this is the way in forensic pathology they solve crimes. Here's the skin under the fingernail of the deceased. It matches the DNA of that full human being, and that full human being has free will, and they are blameworthy if they use a free will to kill this innocent person, and therefore we punish that person. So we treat them like a person, right? Point being here is we know who the person is. I should say we have the skin, and the skin under the nails only comes from another full human person. So with regards to the cells in the cheek, I can ask, what is, yeah, those are human cells, what person did they come from,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's you, your cheek, right? Then we've got the zygote, and we have another clump of cells that maybe even to the naked eye look a bunch like the cells in your cheek. And then I say, if that's not the person, then where is the person those human cells came from?
Right.
Well, they didn't come from any other, not mom, because mom doesn't have the same genetic makeup as those cells. Turns out that at that stage of human development, that small clump of cells called a zygote or a blastocyst is the whole human being.
Right.
The cells in your cheek are not humans. They are human cells that belong to a human. In the case of the cells of in a zygote, those are individual cells that are not human beings. They are human cells that belong to a human, but the human they belong to is the zygote.
Okay, good. I answered correctly then.
Yeah, okay, well, good. Yeah, and that's not that hard. When you think about it a little bit, you see, oh, yeah, that fits together.
Yeah, I've never heard it, and I think just applying logic kind of came on me at the moment, but I did argue that everything came forth from the human person.
Sure. You know, what human person did that come from? Well, in this case, the clump of cells is the human person, because all human persons start that way.
Right.
They all start in this. So people say, well, it doesn't look like a human being. Of course it looks like a human being. It looks exactly as all human beings look like at that stage of development.
Right, right.
And this is where people are confused. They think that fetus is a thing. A fetus isn't a thing. It's a stage of development of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you have human fetus, and you have cat fetus, and you have dog fetus, etc. When we're in fetal stage, we're still human beings, and zygote stage the same.
Right.
Okay. Stay with me for a minute. We got one more minute. What was the next question, real quickly?
With cloning, he also presented the argument of cloning. If a cell that you scrape from your cheek, possibly, in theory, we can clone a human, when would that human person become a person?
Well, as soon as the way they clone a human being from the cell in your cheek is by evacuating the DNA from that cell. So you're not using, you don't make that cell into a human. What you do is you rob it of its DNA core, and then you take a human ovum, and you remove the DNA core from it, which is only half the DNA necessary for a human being, and you put the full allotment of DNA coming from the cell from your cheek into the that ovum, and then you charge it a little bit, and if it begins to divide, you can get a true human being developing from that.
Okay.
That's called somatic cell nuclear transfer, and a lot of people don't realize that's exactly what is made legal by Prop 71, cloning.
It
now,
needs to be stimulated.
Yes, it needs to be stimulated. Now, once that starts developing as a human embryo, it's a real human being at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And all human beings have transcendent value, in my view, in virtue of being human. So I would say that even a cloned human being has that value. That cloned human being simply came into existence in a kind of odd way, in which we manipulated the process, but it still produced the same thing. By the way, you get something similar when you have twinning. Twinning is cloning. So, and twins are human beings, you know, so in person. So anyway, there you go. Keep up the good work, okay, Ty?
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the call. Be back in a moment after this. Stay with us on Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't.
All right, friends, Greg Kochel back with you here on Stand to Reason. Been giving you a piece of my mind today. Got a little bit of a scratchy voice from all the traveling and talking I've been doing the last couple of months, couple of weeks, rather. Been away from this mic. But let me, very quickly, before I get back to your calls, and we do have a shortened show today, we'll try to get as many as we can. This next couple of weeks, November into December, we have a bit of a push to fund our radio show. A lot of you don't realize that not only is this show supported by listeners and those who give to Stand to Reason, but we're only about half funded for the show. That is, people who give regularly to radio for Stand to Reason only pay for half of the radio costs here at KBRT, and we end up pilfering from the general fund of STR. And we'd like to have you think about being a regular donor to Stand to Reason to help our radio work out. Let me just read a quick little note from Edna Martin, who was, it's very sweet, it's self-explanatory. Dear Stand to Reason, here is my small gift of $25. I'm only a teenage girl who doesn't make a big amount of money, or I would love to give more, but I so enjoy your newsletters, and thank you so much for mailing them to me. Just want you to know I appreciate the work you're doing. Keep it up, and thanks again. This is great. $25 is a lot of money for a teenager, I imagine. And I'm glad that she gave that. Thank you, Edna. And maybe that'll inspire you to be thinking, too, what you can be giving to Stand to Reason Radio as a one-time gift or hopefully even as a monthly gift as you help to support us so we can stay on the air. You can contact us. I'll give you the address in just a moment to send a check. Or you can call us at Stand to Reason at 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason during the week. The address to send a check, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Once again, 1438 East 33rd, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And I do hope you would really consider this. I'm not going to ask you to pray about it, see if you feel led. Frankly, I don't care if you feel led or not. If you'd like to give to us and you've been benefiting from what we've been doing, the Bible says that it's appropriate for you to participate financially. So give us a call. And web listeners, what, can give right there on the web, is that right? And those of you who are listening on the web, and I know you're not listening right now, you can also send us a check and help us. And if you're on the web, you can go ahead and use, there's a web feature that will allow you to do that, or those others listening can go to str.org and use the web feature to give to Stand to Reason. Okay, quickly back to the phones. And Gene, welcome to the show.
Greg?
Yes, sir.
Hi. Gosh, I haven't called in a while. Good to be back in there.
Well, I'm glad you called. I'm sorry we're a little tight on time today.
Okay. Well, it's this question that keeps coming up, and I was just listening to your three-tape series on tough questions.
Right.
Is Jesus the Only Way was a tape I listened to last night, which I think is probably the best tape I've ever heard.
Thank you.
So that's number one.
Well, thank you.
I'm teaching a new believer Bible study at our church. And we just had a big outreach a couple weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
and the question came up, and then also at work a few weeks ago, pretty heated discussion, and this one guy basically said, you know, you believe in Christianity, Gene, because you were raised in a country where we promote Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, if you were going to lean one way, that's probably the best option for you.
Right.
What about the guy in another country where he's exposed to another religion and he has that, you know, desire to know God and to, you know, do live right?
Right.
And he reaches out, but what only thing offered him is maybe one religion that's around his
community. Right. Okay, let me answer that quickly for you. First of all, his objection, I think, is misconstrued.
Okay.
You believe in Christianity because you were raised here. Well, so what? I mean, in one sense, maybe it is that we believe in Christianity because we were raised here, but that doesn't mean that, therefore, Christianity must be false. A lot of times people want to dismiss the claims of Christianity by looking at the emotional reasons or sociological reasons why some people happen to become Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you believe in Christianity because you're raised in the States and somebody else believes in Islam because they were raised in another country doesn't tell you anything about whether Christianity or Islam are true.
Right.
And so he's going to have to do better in trying to defeat Christianity to just point to these kinds of things. The fact is, a lot of people who are Christians now were not raised that way. Now, it does raise another question, though. If you have to believe in Jesus to be saved, then what about the person who's never heard?
Mm-hmm.
And here's my quick response. Okay, you'll get it in the next tape. I think The Heathen and the Unknown God is the next one you'll listen to in that tape. Is that one of the three?
I don't think it is.
Okay, well, we also have that. It's called The Heathen and the Unknown God.
Okay.
And I go into detail there, but the first thing I tell him is nobody is sent to hell because he didn't believe in a Jesus that he never heard of.
Right.
Okay? God is going to judge every person by the light that has been shown them. All right?
Mm-hmm.
If the person is genuine in his pursuit of God, then God is going to give him the information that he needs to know about Jesus. And we have a lot of examples of this in missionary work and even in the Bible, where people are doing the best with the information they had. Since your friend stipulated that this person in this Muslim country, excuse me, or whatever, has never really had exposure to any of that, but he really is seeking God.
Mm-hmm.
The genuine seeker of God, the Bible says, will indeed find him. Now, there are a lot of people who are seeking a false God,
mm-hmm.
and they find a false God. But Jesus says, seek and you shall find, knock and the door shall be opened, you know. Whoever calls out in the name of the Lord shall be saved. So people aren't going to hell just because of an accident of geography, is my point. God is only going to condemn people who are actually guilty. And that's just about everybody, right, except
right.
for Jesus. So people don't go to hell because they never heard of Jesus. They go to hell because they violated God's law. And if they have violated it, then it's appropriate for God to punish them. The thing is, though, even where there's no Christian message, there still is another message, God and creation, and Paul talks about that in Romans 1. Yet the problem is people have gladly turned to false gods and an error instead of, as Paul mentions there in chapter 1, instead of turning to the true God. They worship the creature rather than the creator, and for this they're held responsible and there's no excuse. No, that's all right. There are some people who aren't going to be mollified by any explanation, okay? But the fact is that God isn't trying to trick people into going to hell through geographic accident. Only guilty people get punished for sins. And God's evidence is there for everyone to see. If somebody, even in a remote part of the world, responds with genuine interest and a genuine heartfelt pursuit of God, God will move heaven and hell to get the message of Jesus Christ to that person. We've seen it happen before. That's his promise.
And then when it comes to the guilt of their sin because they're breaking God's law, even though they've never heard God's law.
Well, they know God's law. They know they feel guilty because they've broken God's law, and they're doing other things to try to appease God for their own guilt, whether sacrificing to whatever. They know they're guilty.
Right.
It isn't like they don't know, and this is what Paul picks up in chapter 2 of Romans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I that's kind of as quick as I can do. I got to get to some other calls.
Hey, one last thing. You know the show Faith Under Fire?
Yes.
I'm surprised they don't do any commercials on your program to pump up that show.
Oh, well, I would have been glad to. Actually, we were going to interview Lee Strobel, but we couldn't get a hold of him to get him on the air and kind of give him a 20-minute commercial there. But
that program is a godsend. It's been something I've been dreaming of seeing, and there it is.
PAX TV on 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock. Is that right? Or is it 10 to
10 p.m. On Saturday night.
10 to 11 on Saturday night, and got a chance to be on that show, and I think they're going to run it for another season. So,
yeah.
Folks, if you don't know about PAX TV and Faith Under Fire, 10 o'clock Saturday nights, whatever the PAX channel is in your neighborhood. Hey, thanks a lot, Gene, for that call. Should we go to a break right now? Is that what we're up against? Is that right? No. Okay, let's go to Dave. Dave, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, thank you, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And thanks for everything you do. I'm new to STR, and I look forward to delving in further.
Good.
Listen, there's a guy making the talk show circuit now who just wrote a book that is very, very anti-religion. I don't even want to mention the guy's name.
Okay.
On the radio.
Well, that's okay. What's his what's his book? Do you? I mean, I don't know which one you're talking about.
It's The End of Faith.
Oh, okay.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
I've heard a little bit about it, but not much.
Sam Harris, and he's debating many people.
Okay.
And in challenging the Bible, he quotes you know passages from Leviticus and certain passages that many people bring up to challenge the Bible. What resources are there for someone like me to answer
him? Okay, let me give it to you quickly.
Passages that are, I guess, frequent objections.
Right, sure. Gleason Archer's Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulty. Gleason Archer, Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties.
Oh, great.
So that's a standard work where you'll get a lot of the answers. Now, sometimes it's hard to keep up with all the new things people find that they think are contradictions, all right?
Yeah.
But let me tell you an end around here. There's a workaround without having to know a whole lot of things.
Okay.
The only reason there's problems with contradictions is if you're trying to promote to a non-believer inerrancy, that the Bible has no errors in it, and all they've got to do is try to find one of what they think is an error, and then they think they've beaten us. And when you got 66 books, thousands of pages, that's a lot of ground for us to have to defend. Now, I believe in inerrancy.
Right.
However, it is not necessary to prove inerrancy to prove the Christian worldview is true.
Okay.
What we need to do to prove Christianity is we have to show that Jesus Christ lived and died on a cross and rose from the dead.
Right.
Notice that, you know, the early Christians didn't have Bibles. The New Testament wasn't written. Many of the Gentiles didn't have Old Testaments. What they had was a testimony of a risen Christ.
Right.
Now, if the salient details, historical details of the Gospels are true, then we've made our case. Because there we've got a man who claimed remarkable things and then did remarkable things to substantiate the claims. The point is that you can sidestep the whole inerrancy issue. And in fact, I think it's a tricky issue to defend because somebody can always come up with their interpretation of a passage that then makes it look like there's a contradiction. There's a lot of ways to deal with contradictions. It's a complicated thing. Many things have been answered. Even when you answer it fairly, people aren't satisfied. So people like Sam Harris are going to still go off selling lots of books.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean the Christian case has been defeated.
Right.
The Christian case rises and falls on the person of Jesus. And this is why people like the Jesus Seminar are much more dangerous than Sam Harris.
Okay.
Because they're arguing that the Gospels are not historically reliable. And this is not well substantiated by them, but nevertheless, they get a lot of press. So I'd point you to Gleason Archer's book, okay?
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome, and keep in mind this other end around that I was talking about, okay?
That'd be great. I really appreciate everything.
Okay, Dave. Hope you make more trips to our website.
Oh, I do. I visit a lot.
Well, it's good to have you on board.
Great. Thank you.
Sure. Bye-bye now. Okay, friends, we've got to go to a quick break and back to your calls here on Stand to Reason.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from STR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to STR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's STR.org. Okay, in the stretch here at Stand to Reason, just a few minutes left in our show. Remember, for the next 2 months, we're going to have abbreviated shows because we go off the air at sundown here. Sorry for the short trip, but we'll be back on regular schedule come the first of the year. Let's go back to lines and talk with you. Michelle, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi.
Hi there.
If we're going to spend eternity in heaven, why is God going to create a new heaven and a new earth?
When it says the new heavens and the new earth, it might mean, it might mean the heavenly bodies, like the physical heavens as opposed to the earth, but
right.
It probably means, and I'm thinking of the book of Revelation, he does describe this city.
Right.
You know, I don't know. You're saying like he doesn't need to create anything new because we haven't been to heaven yet, so we haven't seen the old heaven yet, and that'll be good enough for us, so why make a new one? Is that?
I don't know what flaw there would be with heaven that he wants a new one, but even besides that, why have a new earth if we're going to be in heaven?
Yeah.
It's going to be on earth too.
Yeah, you know what? That's a good question. But it doesn't. By the way, just because God will recreate it doesn't mean there's any flaw in it. It might be this is the next stage of what he wants to do.
Okay.
That the current heavens and the current earth are appropriate for this stage of
right.
God's plan, and then after the resurrection, when sin is done away with, it's time to make a whole new thing for a new plan, okay? But you know what? I don't know how to answer that question. I've never been asked it, and I have never even thought about it.
Okay.
And my apologies. This deals with eschatology, you know, the final summation of all things, and most of the times I'm kind of occupied with things in the present, and I don't think too much about
I was hoping this didn't get too much into the, well, all of the different eschatological.
Well, I don't think it will because all the eschatological distinctions like pre-mill, post-mill, amillennial, all that stuff, is kind of all resolved by the time that the new heavens and the new earth come around. And there may be certain takes on the new heaven and new earth depending on how you cash out the second coming issue.
Right.
But I don't know them. So I'm kind of an idiot when it comes to those things.
Okay.
So can I just apologize for my ignorance on this one?
No, you make me feel better.
Okay.
You don't know it either, then I don't have to feel dumb.
No, well, you don't have to. You didn't have to feel dumb anyways, but I appreciate the call. Can I offer that next
okay.
time?
Can I ask a follow-up to it?
Okay, since I was dumb on that one, maybe I'll do better on this one.
When I'm reading the phrase heaven in the Bible, I think that I usually, if it's singular, think of that as, you know, heaven where the throne of God is.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And if it's plural, think of that as more likely, you know, the skies.
Yeah, that sounds like a reasonable thing if the rest of the context justifies such a
right.
thing.
Right, but that's kind of a safe.
Yeah, it just sounds like it, yeah.
Okay.
Sounds like a general rule of thumb. I think you're safe on that one.
Okay.
Oh, good, we got one.
All right.
Okay, Michelle, thank you so much for the call. And that leaves David. David, you made it, believe it or
hey.
Not. How you doing?
Greg?
Yes.
Let me see if I can answer a question. Maybe because the fallen angels corrupted Earth from the beginning.
Yeah.
And that's why God needs to create a new heaven and a new Earth.
Well, that's a possibility. I mean, it does talk about the creation itself groaning for its redemption. And then
right.
we'll have that new heaven and new earth. Yeah, that's certainly a credible response. What's on your mind today?
My comment was simply is that when we talk of abortion and we talk of creating babies, especially out of wedlock, but even between married people and they're aborted, why is it that we never think of the contractual aspect between the actual act of sex, I guess, for lack of better description, mm-hmm. is that when a man and a woman engage in an activity such as that, they are actually engaging in a contractual situation. In other words, that if an offspring is created by a man and a woman in that sense, they are now contractually bound to raise up that child.
Well, I'm not
this concept of a contract. I mean, I'm just thinking, before I was a Christian, I had sex with other women, and we never talked about contracts. There was nothing inherent in our conversation about the sexual engagement and involvement that had anything to do with contracts. We were trying to avoid that kind of thing, actually.
Right.
So I'm not sure you're arguing on solid ground here when you bring this into play.
The reason why I bring it into play is simply this, you'd have to be probably one of the most ignorant people on earth or unfortunately mentally retarded to understand that fornication leads to the production.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no question that people are aware, I suspect, as I was then, that offspring could be the result of this union, but that's not the same as saying I have a contractual arrangement with the woman regarding the children. Did we just lose him? What happened? David's voice got funny there for a little while, and then he just disappeared. Well, let me try to respond to that. I didn't do that, David. You did that, so I'll just say goodbye, and maybe you'll call back, although we're almost out of time, aren't we? What we've got here is, this whole point so far doesn't make that much sense to me. Maybe you had more to say about it that would kind of bring it more in focus, but if you're presuming that there's a contract that is implicit in sex, I guess I just have to disagree with that. If you're saying that there is an implicit understanding that a baby could be the result of sex, well, yeah, I'd say that's there, implicit, but certainly not explicit, because I don't think people are, when they're having sex recreationally like that, they're thinking about making babies. That's the last thing from their minds. If they thought about it more often, maybe they would change their activity. But it's not explicit, and it's only implicit in the sense that it's a possibility. And and sometimes it's an actuality, okay? But to suggest from that there is some kind of contract that people are obliged then to fulfill, I don't know. That is not the best way to go about it, it seems to me. I'd rather just forget about that part of the discussion with regards to making my case about abortion. I would rather make my case in a straightforward fashion. I want to say, look, abortion is wrong because it takes the life of an innocent human being. Regardless of how, whether you knew the baby was going to be born, whether you planned it, whether you've got a contract, whether you don't have a contract, inconsequential. What you do have is a baby. Some people say, well, we shouldn't force people to become mothers. Well, I agree. You shouldn't force anyone to become a parent. That's not the question here. The question is whether they're a parent already. And if there's a baby inside the womb growing, that mother is already a mother. She just hasn't met her offspring yet. That father is already a father. They are already parents, and you don't avoid parenthood by killing your offspring, all right? That, I think, is a better way to go than this vague kind of contract business. Well, that's it for the show, ladies and gentlemen. And I will be back in the future for more fun with you and Clear Thinking and Christianity. By the way, this next week, please be intentional about being a good and an effective ambassador for Jesus Christ. That means an accurately informed mind, an artful method, and an attractive manner. And when I return, maybe I'll have a better voice for you than I did today. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Go out and give them heaven this week, my friends. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason to...
What number is this, Chip?
7A.
Okay, no, I mean, don't get excited, man. It's because I'm short, I know.
Oh, I could hide neath the wings of the bluebird as she sings.
I guess this is a monkey's day here.
Along.
Oh, if you only you could see. There's the enforcer behind the screen. There she's kind of dancing and singing and doing her little air guitar without the guitar. Without the air. Greg Kokel back with you at Stand to Reason. And I mentioned just a little while ago when I was talking about embryonic stem cell research that my wife and I have been looking for donor embryos. You know, if you have embryos and you are not sure what to do with them because your family is finished, we would be glad to talk to you about giving those children a chance. And not only would we, so others would as well. And I think that's what should be done with them, not discarded, not just left in the deep freeze forever, but we should treat them like the human beings they are and give them a chance. And if you're willing to do that, interested in doing that, you might want to call 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number, and chat with us about it. Let's go back to the phones here in our final segment. Dave, welcome to Stand to Reason.
On one of the talk shows this morning, Ron Reagan made, among other claims, that Bush's policy regarding embryonic stem cell research funding was internally inconsistent because it was using embryos that had already been killed.
Yes.
And as opposed to using new ones that hadn't been, and he's saying, well, killing is killing.
Okay.
I'd like your comment.
All right. Here we let's put it this way. I have a medical school. I mean, just think about this for a moment. I have a medical school, and I want to have cadavers that the students can dissect in a human necropsy lab and therefore learn about anatomy. Of course, this is done in medical schools all around the country, so I need some cadavers. I could go to the city morgue and get a cadaver, or I could go out in the street and find a bunch of bums and kill them and use their cadavers. Killing is killing, but who is doing the killing is the relevant question here. Do you see the distinction there?
Well, I suppose he would counter that. I'm not taking his position necessarily.
No, that's okay.
But I suppose he would take the position that the situation is not the same as for cadavers, as much as in the case of cadavers, the bodies were killed by something or somebody, so an accident, whatever, as opposed...
Well, what if they were murdered? What if they were murdered? I mean, lots of times you have John Doe's in a city morgue as a result of murder, and those end up in human necropsy labs. I've seen them, you know.
Whereas that would be hard to say, it would be hard to say that there was any other cause of death in the case of the embryo.
Well, let's just stipulate that in the case of embryos, these embryos died because somebody was cutting them up. They killed the embryos, just as these bodies, these corpses were dead because somebody shot them in the street or something like that. All I'm saying is, if we reflect upon this, we can see a clear moral difference between using the byproducts of someone who is already dead or was killed prior to that and making some good out of it, and killing the person in order to get their byproducts. It's not the president that's morally confused here. It's Ron Reagan that is deeply confused if he can't see that distinction. It's a stunner to me that he would say such a thing. I just don't get it.
He did, though.
I do not have a high view of Mr. Reagan on anything, and when I saw the deception that he tried to pull off of the DNC, where he described somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is also known as cloning, and refused to call it that because he knew everybody would be really upset, then I knew the man is a person who is a demagogue. He wants to confuse and deceive in order to get what he wants. He won't tell the truth. I'm going to tell you the truth about this matter. And I think President Bush will too, although I don't think he's as good at doing so clearly and powerfully and effectively. He's just not that great a communicator, so he can't really slam the point home when it could have been done. But he's got the goods, as it were. And so when Ron Reagan says, well, it's killing's killing, what difference does it make? Well, it makes a big difference. By the way, there are some people who would hold that since the embryos died in this fashion, that they were killed for their body parts, and that was immoral, then you also participate in the immorality by using the body parts themselves. I don't think that's a good argument, personally, but I'm sympathetic to those who want to argue that way. I can understand that. I just don't think it works. And many, for example, a lot of science, factual information that was helpful to science was gained in concentration camps, particularly about how human beings react to hypothermia. But that's because human specimens were used against their will and slowly frozen to death in the Nazi concentration camps at the hands of Mengele and others like him. And therefore, the research that was and the knowledge that was gained, many people think, is tainted, and they wouldn't use that knowledge, even though it could help somebody else because of the source from which it came. Now, I don't hold that view, but I'm sympathetic to people having a view like that. I don't think that you're participating in the evil when you take the facts that came from it and you make use of this, as long as the use now is not encouraging the behavior in the future. Then you might have a problem. But that wasn't the case with the Nazis, I don't see, and I don't see using the stem cell lines now is an encouragement to do that in the future, especially when the same person who says we can use it is prohibiting new funds to kill new embryos. It strikes me as totally consistent.
Also, Ron claimed in the same show that most of the lines that had been accumulated weren't of any good, and also that directly contradictory to Dobson and others, he claimed that the embryonics were more promising than adults.
Well, okay, this is where clarification needs to be made on both points. First of all, there is some question about the viability or usability of the lines that exist. Okay, fine. Even if I grant that, notice how you put it. I presume you put it the way he said it, that they have more, what was the word you used, possibility or something?
Well,
the embryonic stem cell lines have more, what?
There were two things that I was mentioning. The first is, he said that the 19, well...
I'm not talking about that. It's the second thing that you said.
The second thing is he claimed, contrary to what Dobson and others would say, that the embryonic stem cell research has more possibilities.
Possibilities. Now, this is what's very important. Possibilities. People can imagine the possibilities. It is not currently happening. And, I know there's a lot of Nobel laureates that are on board here. Frankly, I don't have any reason to believe that Nobel laureates are any better moral thinkers than anyone else, and maybe quite the contrary. So that doesn't impress me. But that's the thing is the possibility.
Well, would you say the same thing if instead of possibilities there were more promise?
Well, that all requires qualification. Coming from a man like Ron Reagan and what he said in the past, I'd want to know how he cashes out the idea of promise. There is more actual results currently now happening with adult stem cell research. It's actually happening. They are producing good results. The work that they've done so far with embryonic stem cells has been very problematic because you have massive opportunity for tumors to grow, and as a result of that, it creates more difficulty. So they could say, yes, but if we overcome that, then this has more promise. In theory, they think this might be the case, but in actual fact, they haven't demonstrated that they can do what they hope to do in theory. That's the distinction there. And that maybe they can nail this sucker, and 10 years from now, they're producing all these kinds of things. Fine, let's just be honest about the nature of the circumstances right now. Right now, and forever, when you take embryonic stem cells, you kill a human embryo, first of all. Secondly, right now, stem cells taken from adults are doing much more good without the ethical difficulties, and we actually have things dealing with Parkinson's and the like from adult stem cells. And we don't know what we can produce with the others, even though some people have high hopes. By the way, on this list here, on the brochure for Yes on 71, they list not only diabetes, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's disease. Nobody that I know of says that stem cell research is going to cure Alzheimer's, because Alzheimer's isn't just one thing. It's a whole bunch of things that come together. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I see cancer on here too. I don't know what they're making up here, because I know they're making up the Alzheimer's thing. I know they're making that up. So who knows what else they're making up here. But I do know with Parkinson's, there are already therapies that have been developed with adult stem cell research that are working. So what's the, you know, this is all upside down, backwards, and inside out. The good money, the good thinking is with adult stem cell research. Why fuss with this other stuff? Do the best you can with existing lines, fine, but let's not kill more human beings so that Christopher Reeves can walk. Did you know that both the vice presidential candidate and the presidential candidate for the Democrats said, almost quote, that when we're elected, people like Christopher Reeves will not die, but will get out of their wheelchairs and walk. Quote, unquote. I heard them both. Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Dave, thank you for the call. Yeah. I got to run to another caller here. And Bobby, you've been waiting a long time. Thanks a lot for your patience.
Hi, Greg. First of all, thank you. I haven't said thank you in a long time for your ministry.
Well, you're a sweet one, and I'm always glad that we can help you guys out, and you help us out, and thanks so much, Bobby.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I've been playing tennis with your buddy Pete, by the way.
Oh, yes, I heard. I hope you have a good time with him. Yeah, he's a good student. I wanted to try to run an argument by you because I so admire your quality of thinking that I thought I'd run it by you.
Thanks. I'll do my best here.
It's on the controversial.
I'm putting my thinking hat on right now, Bobby. Okay. So I'm putting on my most academic look here.
Okay. It's 1 Timothy 2:12, which is the salient verse there. Paul says, I do not permit a woman to teach her authority over a man.
Yes. Okay.
Be silent. And I'm suggesting that it's an authoritative doctrinal instruction he's talking about because of the entire context, which is set up in 1 Timothy 3:15. He describes the weight of the faith and the truth of God's gospel that is going to be delegated or spread in this house of God, he calls it God's household.
Right.
Okay, so if we go back to verses 8, 9, and 10, right before he says a woman, and I know some choose to say that a wife would be a better translation.
Yeah, let me just read the passage here. Therefore, I want the men in every place to pray, lifting up holy hands without wrath or dissension. Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing. This is your verse 8 and 9, modestly and discreetly. Not with braided hair, gold, or pearls, or costly garments, but rather by means of good works and benefits befits a woman making a claim for godliness. Verse 11, let a woman quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness, but I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. Then he goes into the creation order after that. I'm reading out of the New American Standard because I think the precision of the words is important here.
Yeah. That's good. And what I want to say is that because he speaks to men generally in verse 8, and then he goes to women, that I think that he is speaking generally to both genders. And wives or husbands, even the word husband in verse 8 would not sit well.
Yeah. Excuse me. Okay, let me quickly, because we're short on time here, let me do the best I can.
Okay.
I actually hold the view that chapter 2 in those passages is better understood as talking about the relationships of husbands and wives and not the relationship of women in leadership in the church. The leadership issue per se is addressed in chapter 3, which starts, it's a trustworthy straight statement if any man aspires to the office of overseer, it's a fine work he desires to do, and then he gives in qualifications of overseer. I see chapter 2 dealing with the general assembly, which would entail families, of course, and chapter 3 dealing with leadership. And in the general assembly, there are relationships in that, of course, most people are married at this time. There are relationships, and there's certain proper interactions with those relationships. And I look at the wording in verse 11 and 12, specifically, let a woman, particular woman, it didn't say let women receive instruction from men. It says let a woman quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness, a phrase which strikes me most appropriate inside of marriage from Paul's perspective and not in the church. Because, Bobby, you're a woman in the church, and I don't think you have any obligation to obey me, Greg Kokel, since I'm a man, with entire submissiveness. Every woman would have to be entirely submissive to every man in the church if that were the case.
But in the context in which I'm speaking, which is the congregational setting, which I think he says in 3:15, Greg.
Yeah, but 3:15 is the chapter where he is talking about the spiritual leadership.
Why he wrote the whole letter.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
He says, this is why I wrote the letter. I can read it right now. It says,
how we ought to conduct ourselves in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth.
I'm writing you these instructions so that, how people ought to conduct themselves
right. In
God's household.
I don't see any conflict with that statement there and what I have outlined, because the conduct in God's household entails lots of different things, relationships between husbands and wives, and also with regards to leadership before the congregation itself. And it's the specific wording from my perspective. I do not allow a woman to teach, verse 12, or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. And so, and I think basically it's saying that in both words, woman and man, can be translated, as you know, gune and aner can be translated as wife and husband, and are consistently done so with very few exceptions when men and women are in relationship with each other. This is one of the exceptions. They break with the trend here, and I ask myself why, because it seems to me, if he's talking about the men who are heads of households, their responsibility is to pray and do these things, and then the women are to receive instruction from their husbands and not be the teacher of their husbands. They are to be the spiritual heads of their family. Then in chapter 3, he switches over into the leadership issues and the way things ought to be done in the church. I, by the way, do think that you can make a case from chapter 3 against women being pastors and being the head leaders of the church from chapter 3, but not, I think, in chapter 2 he's making a different claim. Bobby, sorry about the short shrift here. Maybe we can pick this up next time we're on the show, and you can call and we'll talk about it some more. Okay, I appreciate so much hearing from you. Take care, dear. All right, that's all the time that we have, ladies and gentlemen, for today. And I look forward to hearing from you next week and talking with you when we get together again. In the meantime, be a good ambassador for Christ with an accurately informed mind, an artful method, and an attractive manner. Knowledge, wisdom, character. And give them heaven at the same time. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye.